Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-30186, State v. DePoyt. Arguing for the petitioner, Craig Jerome. Arguing for the respondent, Emlyn Higa. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Jerome and Mr. Higa. Are you both ready to proceed today?
Yes.
All right. And my understanding, Mr. Jerome, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning light when we get to that point. Mr. Higa, we will give you a warning with 5 minutes left to go in your argument. Please proceed, Mr. Jerome.
Good morning. Deputy Public Defender Craig Jerome, appearing on behalf of the petitioner, FLE, Herman L. DePoyt. Good morning again to the court, Chief Justice and Associate Justice of the court. Thank you for your time today. Essentially, we presented two questions in our writ of certiorari in this case. The first was whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that abuse of a family or household member could be charged as a continuing offense. And two, whether the ICA gravely erred in relying on the state's proffers of its anticipated evidence to support its holding in this case. With the court's permission, I'd like to deal with the first of these issues to start off with. Now, what the state is asking the court to recognize here is a new offense of continuous abuse of family or household member. This offense would be comprised of multiple, interrupted, discrete, culpable instances of physical abuse over an extended period of time that somehow are transformed into a singular offense based on nothing more than the generalized nature of domestic violence within relationships.
How is that different than assault?
Excuse me?
How would that be different than assault in the first degree, assault in the second degree, or any of these other offenses that the courts have held were continuing?
Well, I think that the distinction is that I don't know if the courts have held that those could be charged as continuing offenses over an extended period of time if they're comprised of separate physical altercations that result in separate results in conduct. I think that there needs to be a distinction drawn between whether or not an offense can be charged as a continuing offense versus whether or not, based on the evidence at trial, it can be proven as a continuous offense. And I think it may be helpful to go back to Arceo, which is, you know, certainly one of the most seminal cases in this jurisdiction as far as what a continuous offense is. Obviously, and I'm sure the court's aware, in Arceo, the prosecution's position was that it had charged the offenses in that case as continuous courses of conduct over an extended period of time, and the defense's position was that the prosecution was not allowed to do that because there was no such offense as continuous sexual assault in the first or third degree. And the court in Arceo phrased the threshold question as follows. The mutually exclusive position advanced by the parties in this appeal generate a threshold question, namely, whether, as the prosecution maintains, Arceo's alleged repeated acts occurring over a period of time could be aggregated into a two-count indictment on the basis that Arceo essentially engaged in two continuous offenses, sexual contact with a minor and sexual penetration of a minor. The court then said, in order to answer this question, we must analyze the elements of the offenses with which Arceo was charged and of which he was convicted, and determine, within the context of the statutory scheme created by the Hawaii Penal Code, whether it's possible for them to be continuing. And finally, the court said it must consider the potential ramifications of treating them as such. I think that's the threshold question and the threshold inquiry in this case. In this case, the inquiry is whether DePoyt's alleged repeated, discrete, interrupted acts of physical abuse occurring over a 28-month period may be aggregated into a one-count complaint on the basis that he engaged in one continuous offense of abuse of family or household member during the charged period.
Suppose the defendant had announced to his spouse that I am going to slug you once every 6 hours for the next year. Is that continuing or is that separate?
I believe that because the acts, the culpable acts are separate, that would be a separate course of conduct.
Okay, what happens if it was once every hour?
I believe it's the same analysis.
Every 5 minutes?
Well, now we're getting more into the question of whether it's a singular incident or it's multiple incidents. But again, if he's expressing my intent is to cause you repeated physical pain over some extended period of time, I believe that each incident, each act of causing physical pain could be charged as a separate offense.
And it could be charged as a continuous course of conduct if there was one intent.
Well, I don't believe it can be charged as a continuous course of conduct because I don't think that that's a question that's left at the discretion of the prosecution. It's either a continuous offense or it's not a continuous offense.
Okay. Does the statute in any way limit it?
The statute does not limit it other than the fact that the language that the legislature has chosen, physical abuse, is a discrete act with a discrete result.
Maltreatment seems to you a singular act?
Well, it's maltreatment resulting in bodily injury. And bodily injury is defined as simply pain. So it's maltreatment that causes physical pain, which is instantaneous.
But again, you know, we've looked at assault incidents, assault cases, and whenever we don't split up every hit or striking into separate offenses. It's not defined like sexual assault, but there's a specific definition.
Well, that's the issue that was presented in State v. Aki, is that was an abuse case where there's a pulling of the hair and a pushing or a slap in the mouth, and the court in that case held that that was a continuous offense because it was a single physical altercation. It was one incident and one act. In Aki, there's one actus reus, there's one singular intent, and there's a singular result of conduct. It's not split up into separate incidents. It's also what's said in Valentine, which is the attempted unlawful possession of a firearm case, which is that they said the evidence adduced at trial didn't establish that there was more than one incident during which Valentine engaged in conduct constituting an attempt to possess a firearm.
But isn't that a different issue? I mean, I may agree with you on your distinction on single incident or multiple incident, but that's a different issue on whether or not an offense is defined as continuing or not. In other words, an offense can be defined as continuing like assault, but if it's in one incident or two incidents, that will make the difference on whether an arsenal instruction is given.
And it also makes a difference as far as the difference is, I believe it's a different standard as far as whether or not we need a jury unanimity instruction versus whether or not it can be charged as one offense. If you had two assaults that took place 2 months apart from one another with the same complaining witness, I don't believe that you can charge those as one offense.
And if it was 2 hours apart, maybe. So it becomes a factual determination?
I believe it's a factual determination as far as whether or not there are independent incidents that violate the statute. And that's what Raposa says. Raposa says that Arceo is implicated only when there are independent incidents. And, you know, part of the reason why unanimity instructions come up is because the prosecution may not be aware of what the evidence is going to be at trial. So they may think there's only one punch or one kick or one shove, and then the complainant comes in and says, oh, no, he punched me three times. And in that case, the prosecution hasn't chosen to prosecute it as a continuous offense. This is what is required based on the evidence that's come out of the trial. And to go back to the problem with charging multiple distinct repetitive instances of culpable conduct over an extended period of time, if that's left to the discretion of the prosecution, is the Modica issue that's discussed in Arceo.
Why can't the judge, as a matter of law, decide that it's not one incident or two incidents? You just referenced it as being a factual call, but doesn't the judge in almost all these cases you've just mentioned, when the judge decides whether or not to give a jury instruction on whether or not they're going to give a continuing offense instruction, the judge will look at it and say, look, there's nothing here indicating that we have multiple incidents here. So I don't see why the judge can't, as a matter of the law, determine whether or not there's multiple incidents or whether there's sufficient facts to even determine whether or not there's multiple incidents or just one.
Well, I think that the judge does have the power to do that. The problem with saying, well, that would mean that the prosecution could charge anything as a continuing offense and then leave it up to the judge at trial or prior to trial to say, oh, well, this is actually not a continuous offense.
Isn't that what happened here?
That is what happened here.
So what would prohibit the judge from saying, look, unless the government produces some evidence to show that this was a single incident, I'm dismissing it.
And that's what the judge did here, essentially.
But based on a different ground.
Based on a different grounds, but if this court decides that that was the correct thing to do, it can affirm the court's order, even though it was decided for the wrong reason. But we still maintain that that's not the wrong reason. And the problem with allowing the prosecution to do what it did in this case is, again, it raises this Modica issue, which was discussed extensively in Arceo, which is the elements to prove the offense of continuous abuse of family or household member. There has to be more than one offense, obviously, more than one incident for it to be continuous. It's the exact same elements as would be required to prove multiple counts, singular counts of abuse of family or household member. So it's up to the prosecution's whim to decide whether or not the defendant is going to be charged with one offense or multiple offenses based on exactly the same culpable conduct. And that raises due process concerns, double jeopardy concerns, and equal protection concerns.
Well, there's somewhat of a different issue there. Didn't it elevate it between a felony and a misdemeanor? That was one concern.
Well, but Arceo specifically talks about the distinction between multiple counts and singular counts. Because multiple counts theoretically expose the defendant to a much larger punishment, a much larger liability. If the defendant, I mean, the state proffered evidence in this case that DePoy had allegedly physically abused the complainant 50 times over the period. He's charged with 50 counts for exactly the same conduct as they're using to prove one count. That certainly exposes him to a much larger potential penalty than being charged with one count.
Then wouldn't you want it to be charged as one continuous offense instead of multiple charges?
In some instances, it may benefit the defendant to allow it to be charged as a continuous course of conduct. And looking at the legislative history, I don't think that's what the legislature intended. The legislature did not intend to give the prosecution discretion to decide who gets a greater penalty and who gets a lesser penalty. And that when they put in the repeat offender statute, they specifically say that one of the reasons they're doing that is they want to remove discretion and disparity in sentencing based on various court officers or judges.
The prosecutor may have a decision to charge, but the prosecution would have to prove a continuous course in order to lump all those acts under one. In other words, if the prosecution fails, then the prosecution's lost the big gamble. In other words, instead of being able to get 50 convictions, for your example, if they put all 50 together and the government doesn't prove that all of them occurred in a continuing course, they may have lost their case.
Well, theoretically, I guess that's true, and that is required, but, you know, and I believe that's part of the motivation for the prosecution in this case to try to charge this as one continuous offense is in order to backdoor incidents and evidence that may not be allowed if it was charged as multiple counts or in multiple criminal cases. And the prosecution essentially admits that in the opening brief, that they're doing this because they may have proof problems if they charge something individually. And I don't believe that that's what the purpose of a continuous offense is. And the other issue in this case, and one of the reasons why it may not benefit certain defendants to have it charged as a continuous offense, is this allows the prosecution to bring in incidents that would otherwise be barred by the statute of limitations. So if you have a relationship where somebody's married to somebody for 10 years, and there's an incident that happens a week ago, and then all of a sudden the person says, oh, well, he's been doing this to me our entire relationship, the prosecution is able to introduce then and charge conduct from 10 years ago that would otherwise be barred. And the problem with that, and this court recognized as recently as last week or the week before in Flores, is that if you give a jury enough evidence that somebody's done something wrong, regardless of what instruction they're given, it's very difficult for a jury to follow the exact letter of the law and acquit somebody based on a technicality.
Isn't the difficulty even greater, I think, that I don't know if you've I tried to think through how the jury would be instructed in this case, and I found it very confusing because I thought, well, first I'd have to tell the jury they'd have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt what was the most recent event, when did it occur. They'd have to do that because if they don't bypass the statute of limitations, so they're going to have to do that. But even if they don't prove that it's a continuing course, what do? Do they tell the jury, look, you know that 2005 incident, you're supposed to disregard it? Is that what happens? Well, you see what I'm saying? In other words, if they don't prove it's a continuing course, then they've entered in that first incident, I think it was from 2000, November 29, 2006, they'd have to tell the jury to disregard it, even though it had already been introduced.
Well, I don't believe if they didn't prove it was a continuous course of conduct, I think the jury would have to be instructed they'd have to acquit the defendant altogether.
Well, they could prove the second one and not the third one or something. In other words, you get in this really bizarre situation that you're telling the jury to disregard stuff that's already been submitted into evidence based on their findings. I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, I'm not sure, and I was trying to imagine what the jury instructions in this case would look like. I mean, I guess first of all, you'd have to instruct the jury that they have to find that there was some culpable incident that extended beyond April 3rd of 2009 when this was, or April 3rd of 2007 in order to bring it within the statute of limitations. I mean, I guess that would be a question for the jury to decide. But under the state's theory, I guess they could argue that as long as they're in a relationship, even if there's no distinct act of physical abuse, based on their theory of the cyclical nature of violence.
I don't think so. That's not what our law is on. In fact, Martin says that the government has to prove that the date of the most recent act of a continuing offense governs the application of the statute of limitations. They have to prove an act occurred in those 2 months that gives them, that brought them within the window. And did they provide anything to the defense that indicated what that act was or when it occurred?
I don't believe that at any point during this case they offered anything to establish why the statute of limitations should extend beyond the second incident for which we received a police report and discovery.
And there was a motion to dismiss on statute of limitations, correct?
That's correct.
And the judge didn't even meet it. But that would be another way to sustain the judge's ruling.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if the judge ruled on the statute of limitations issue or not, but I don't think the judge specifically, it's not in the conclusions of law and the findings of facts. I believe it's discussed in the oral argument. Oral argument and his oral findings, but there's no specific ruling, I don't think. And that's the other issue in this case, is that that's what was provided to us in discovery was two police reports. And it's not until after this motion is filed that all of a sudden the state comes up with this other proffered evidence.
Is the test based on us looking at the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. As far as whether or not it can be charged as a continuous offense.
So Arceo said we just look at whether the statute defines the offense as an uninterrupted and continuing course of conduct. That's one.
That's correct.
And if you look at the abuse statute, does it define the offense of abuse as an uninterrupted and continuing course of conduct?
Not specifically. I mean, it doesn't say that it can either be statute defined as an uninterrupted.
Not specifically, not expressly.
Or it can manifest a plain legislative purpose to be treated as.
I didn't get there yet. But looking at 709-906C, it talks about an instance of abuse and what the officer has to do when an incident occurs. So when you speak of an incident, would that focus on a particular act and not a continuous course of conduct?
Well, I believe that if something is simply one incident, then there's one actus reus. I mean, an incident, I guess, could be composed of multiple separate instances of physical abuse over a period of days, but that's, subsection C is not defining the element. It's saying what the police officer has to do if he believes that an incident has occurred or when the incident.
No, but it's part of the statute, right? So when you get to the definition of the penalties, it talks about a first offense and a second offense within 1 year and a third offense within 2 years of the second conviction. So does that indicate that each offense is a separate incident or a continuing offense?
That would indicate that each offense is a separate incident.
doesn't it really indicate nothing in the sense that when the statute was passed, it didn't even have those aggravated penalties? And those didn't start until, what, 1990? I have it somewhere. But it certainly the statute, I don't think the statute had those. It was 1992 that it was amended, I think, that they served the minimum 48 hours in subsequent offenses. So it seems to me when the statute was drafted, we have to go on, we can't look at other things. I mean, it didn't suddenly transform from a continuing offense to a non-continuing based on enhancement of penalties.
Well, I think that the subsequent legislative amendments to the statute just helped to clarify what the legislature's original purpose was in drafting the statute and the...
Well, but those apply in this case, right?
Yes.
So if you said this is a continuing offense and you charge the third incident, then for, in effect, three offenses, the penalty would be 48 hours in jail? Because it would be one offense, one continuous offense.
I'm not sure that I, if it's charged as three counts, you mean, or if it's charged as three separate offenses?
No, if it's charged as one continuous offense, one continuous course of conduct, and there were three acts, but you charge only at the third act, then the first and second would be part of a continuous course of conduct, so the penalty would be just 48 hours?
That's correct.
Whereas if you took the position that each offense is a separate act, that would give meaning to this graduated system of penalties, right?
That's correct. And if you charged, let's say there were two separate incidents.
So if you talk about, 48 hours and 1 year, then 2 years, and you, at each point, assess a greater penalty, wouldn't that indicate that the legislature was treating each incident as a separate offense?
Yes, and that's what we argued, is that the legislature intends for each subsequent incident to result in greater penalties. So it's intending for them to be prosecuted and convicted.
So in a sense, when the prosecution tries to rein in these acts that were not charged within 2 years of the incident, they in effect would have to argue for a lesser penalty than would have been imposed had the offense been charged within, 2 years of the act?
That's correct.
The other part in our sale says, or manifests a plain legislative purpose to be treated as a continuing course of conduct. Is there anything in this abuse statute that manifests an obvious or plain legislative purpose to treat it as a continuing course of conduct?
No, I don't believe that there is. Unlike the other statutes that this court and the ICA have determined to be continuous offenses, where based on the nature of the conduct, certain conduct has to be continuous or can be continuous, like in the theft in the first degree statute, the act of deception, the act of exerting unauthorized control over somebody.
Haven't they held attempted second degree murder, attempted first and second degree assault, all sorts of possessory drug offenses, manufacturing? Haven't those all been held to be continuing offenses?
Well, I think that there's possession, obviously, I think possession, the verb possession denotes something that takes place over a period of time, because there's an instruction for possession that says if possession is fleeting or instantaneous, that doesn't constitute criminal possession. I think that there needs to be a distinction drawn with attempt crimes, because an attempt is something that can take place over a period of time. First degree murder seems to be the exception to that rule, and that's recognized, I believe, in either Rabago or Raposa, but the thing about first-degree murder is there has to be two separate incidents of causing the death of another. and it's not divisible into two counts of second-degree murder because second-degree murder isn't a lesser-included offense. So if you look at all of these offenses that the court has held can be charged as continuous offenses, they all have some sort of actus reus that can or must exist over a period of time versus the causing of physical pain, which is instantaneous.
Okay, but you've just agreed previously that if you have an abuse case, and I think you cited a case, I don't know if it was Hiranaka or Aki, where there was multiple incidents. There was a pushing and there was a hitting and all those kinds of different, I mean, under your theory, what you're basically saying is that that every single physical contact that results in mistreatment, it constitutes a separate offense.
The thing about Aki and what the court says in Aki is that this was one act. It's one incident.
Okay, it's one incident.
It's divisible into separate acts.
Right, but the distinction is being made, and I'm restating, the distinction is not being made on continuing, but on whether it's or not it's within one incident.
And there's also the distinction between whether or not the crime can be charged as a continuous offense versus based on the evidence that comes out at trial, whether or not a unanimity instruction is required. And I think that's a distinction that exists in Arceo. Arceo does a two-step analysis. It says, is this a crime that can be charged as a continuous offense? And then it goes into a second analysis, which is a jury unanimity instruction required? And I think they implicate two different things, and I think that that's why there's a separate, different test in Apao that the prosecution ask the court to adopt as far as the question of whether or not something can be charged as a continuous offense. But I see that my time is up, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Very well. Mr. Higa?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Emlyn Higa. I'm the deputy prosecutor attorney representing the state and respondent in this case.
Mr. Higa, let me ask you. This case is charged on April 3rd, 2009. And when discovery is requested, two incidents are produced, police reports are produced to the defendant that detail incidents that occurred November 22, 2006 and March 13, 2007, incidents clearly outside the statute of limitations, you would agree?
Yes.
Why isn't the charging of this as a continuing offense an blatant attempt to bootstrap these other incidents that are clearly outside the statute?
If it was, as the defense has stated, a number of distinct, unconnected incidents.
November 22nd, 2006 and March 13th, 2007?
And that's not the sum total of the evidence right. that we anticipate would be presented at trial. That's only what we have in police reports. That's only what we have in documentation.
But did you produce any
did you
evidence?
Turn off your cell phone? I'm sorry, it's very distracting.
No, I didn't see that.
Sorry.
Did you produce any evidence at the motion to dismiss as to the date of the most recent act of the continuing offense that you're postulating?
I don't recall specifically. It might have been in the petition for the TRO, which outlined many of the facts that would have been presented at trial.
You know, the questions were asked earlier as to the subsection of the abuse statute that says that the police, you know, for each incident, the stay away order. So does that then are we saying that these are all one incident?
I'm sorry, as to the stay away orders?
Right.
You mean when
so
the police
what happens
show
to the
stay away
orders? What happens to stay away orders if this is all just one continuous offense?
I don't think it doesn't have an effect on the stay away orders. If there's an incident.
Don't you have a serious Monica problem here? I mean, you know, we've done a lot of these cases. The usual way is to charge separate counts for separate occasions, separate incidents. If, you know, we've had many cases that there are multiple counts based on separate incidents of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to say that 50 years of abuse can be one continuous offense and it's a misdemeanor? That's it?
50 years.
And then if you do it that way, you have a serious Monica problem.
We would have a Monica problem if we were trying to convict the defendant both of the continuous offense and the discrete offenses within that same time period. The same offenses within that same time period.
I see. So that's not occurring here for this defendant?
I'm sorry?
That's not happening with this defendant?
No, he's charged with one count of abuse as a continuing course of conduct.
He has no separate cases? He's no other cases pending against this defendant?
There is nothing else pending against this defendant. He was on probation.
Isn't there a felony?
There was a felony charge. What happened?
Charge?
He pled to a reduced misdemeanor on that, and I think that his probation was concluded.
When did that occur?
That occurred after the period that is charged in this case.
I see. So everything up to this case is a continuing, and then the subsequent one is not a continuing.
Right.
What's the logic behind that?
They had separated. They were no longer having an ongoing relationship.
I'm sorry, but abuse, family and household members defined as people that did do or used to live together. So there's no difference on that basis.
Well, you asked why was the subsequent incident not charged as a continuing course of conduct or...
Right. Why would that be a separate charge? Why doesn't this case get pulled into that subsequent charge if this is all one continuous offense?
It was a strangulation, so it was charged as a felony. It occurred after this particular time period.
So isn't that what Modica says? That if you have a choice of, you know, charging as a, well, Modica, I believe, was a full misdemeanor and a petty misdemeanor. But so I'm very confused.
Conceivably, I think we could have chosen not to charge the subsequent incident as a separate offense, either amended or recharged to extend the period of the continuous course of conduct to include the strangulation so that now the entire period would be basically extended to incorporate the newer incident. That is legally conceivable.
Yeah, Mr. Higa, if you prevail on this, it seems to me you are opening up this incredible argument for the defense. Any time that the government charges more than one abuse in a complaint or an indictment, the defense is going to argue, hey, this is a continuing course, and all of these four counts that are alleged in this charge, I'm entitled to a continuing course. That's the argument that you're actually... Have you talked to the fellow members of the law enforcement coalition? Is this something that they want?
I have not, but I agree. I think a better example of that is violations of protective order. Say there's a protective order that says no contact. The defendant is alleged to have called or contacted in any way, email, call, whatever, 50 times in 2 days. We have pictures of the text messages, we have voicemails, we have everything showing that basically every half hour he's calling her, okay? 50 times in the last 2 days, 50 counts. I agree, I think the defense could come in and say, you know what, there's a single plan, a single intent, a single scheme.
How does this differ? You are saying that if people live together in an intimate relationship and it's an abusive relationship for 50 years, it's one misdemeanor. Aren't you minimizing the impact of this crime?
Conceivably, it could be charged as a misdemeanor if we were within the statute.
Isn't that what you're saying right here? That's what you're trying to do in this case.
I'm saying that that is a tool that the prosecutor should have available to him or her to either charge it all as a continuing course of conduct or to charge.
You recognize that if we hold that this is a continuing offense, you have a serious Modica problem. Do you recognize that?
I don't agree. If we were trying to have it both ways in a single case, then yes.
So
but that's not what we're
it's
doing.
Either continue. I see. So you get to choose, depending on the defendant, whether you're going to charge as a continuous offense or
depending
a
on the
offense.
Case, that's within our prosecutorial discretion to charge and to decide what charge to bring. We had a few years ago, somebody else charged the case. It charged as a continuing course of conduct. I think the period was about 2 months. I didn't charge it, but I took it to trial. In debriefing, the jury acquitted. In debriefing them afterwards, they said the reason they acquitted, they would have convicted on a couple of the incidents of abuse that were put in evidence. But the instruction was we have to prove that they were connected with a single intent, a single scheme, et cetera. They couldn't find the connection beyond a reasonable doubt. They could find the causing physical pain intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly on certain specific incidents within that that period of time. But because they couldn't find the continuity, they said that's why they felt, and they felt a little frustrated.
And that didn't deter your office from charging this case? I mean, we're just talking about this is going to be the most very, very difficult. You're going to have to prove one intent or you're giving up. And what's the most recent act? I mean, we're getting back. You do not get bypass the statute of limitations unless you can allege and prove a specific act within the period. And yet you gave the defense nothing about that incident. Where's the notice?
There are, besides the police reports and the TRO petition, everything else would have to be produced either in response to a bill of particulars or, as in any other case, through investigation by the defense.
Wait a minute.
To talk to the complaining witness.
There's a motion to dismiss for failure to comply with the statute of limitations. I think when you get them, I mean, it's bad enough, I think, it's not in the charge, and the law is kind of unclear. Certainly, if there's a tolling period, it has to be in the charge. This one doesn't have a tolling period, but even if you don't have to specify in the charge what the date of that act was, and the statute seems to indicate you might have to, but even if you don't, when there's a motion to dismiss, how do you survive it if you don't say, look at that last act, this is the last act that brings us within the statute of limitations, this is when it occurred, this is what happened.
Okay.
Did you do that?
That was part of the discussion, but the motion was not to dismiss on the basis of statute of limitations. The motion to dismiss was on a legal issue, basically that the abuse statute would not permit, that it doesn't admit of a continuing course of conduct.
Page 11 of the transcript, the court. You are moving to dismiss because of the statute of limitations. Are you also moving to dismiss for a defect in the charge? The defense attorney, yes, Your Honor. And then he goes on about the defective charge. And then he says, basically, if dismissed on defective charge, I figure it'd come back, that would be left to two things that fall outside the statute of limitations. So it was raised.
It was raised, but the basis of the motion and the basis of the decision was that abuse does not admit of being charged with a continuing course of conduct. Now, one of the reasons that the judge said so is the statute of limitation. He was uncomfortable, even assuming that we complied with the statute, that we had the last act within that continuing course of conduct was within the 2 years. The lower court judge expressed that he was uncomfortable with the fact that most of that period was outside of the two-year period. And that was his discomfort as far as the statute of limitations. But this was not in the nature of a judgment of acquittal, that we didn't produce enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that we were within the statute of limitations. That it was on the issue of whether legally, can abuse ever be charged as a continuing course of conduct? Regardless of any kind of factual issues, does the law allow us to do that? That was the basis for the motion, and that was the basis for the conclusions of law and the granting of the dismissal.
Mr. Higa, clearly this is a serious matter, and the incidents that the prosecutor, I don't know what it was, at the motion mentioned are grievous instances. So I understand the motive to wanting to bring those kind of incidents to the attention of the court, even though they're outside the statute of limitations. However, the problems that are going to arise to you and your office if allowed to charge this as a continuous offense, and not just combating motions to dismiss, but regarding matters of proof, might you want to rethink charging, asking us to construe it as a continuous offense?
Well, I'm asking the court to construe it as allowing it to be charged as a continuing course of conduct. You know, I think that I agree that a continuing course of conduct case is going to be harder to prove at trial than a single incident case. And that's going to be on us. But what goes into the decision of charging as a continuing course of conduct or as a single incident or several single incidents is context. Is it a better case to give the jury the entire context that this is what all of these incidents of physical violence mean, that they're really part of a whole? Look at it in the context of what was truly going on at this time. If a man walks, I'm not telling a joke here, but if a man walks into a bar and pulls a gun and empties the register, you don't need any other context than what happened when he went into the bar, pulled a gun, and emptied the register. There's no, you don't need to know what the prior relationship is between him, unless there's a credibility issue, of course. But
I totally understand that your argument that, so when you isolate an incident, sometimes it doesn't, the jury, the fact finder doesn't get the full flavor of actually what the whole relationship was. But don't we have cases where we allowed other uncharged incidents to allow the finder of fact to understand what that relationship was like?
Yes. But in this case, it's not just getting the flavor of the relationship. It's not just, it's giving the jury the truth about the crime. The crime was not this slap. The crime was the entire course of abuse that took place over a given period of time. And to just isolate, in certain cases, to just isolate one slap or one punch is not telling the whole truth to the jury. The bar holdup, there's no other truth than that. But in abuse, in many cases, it's not just that single incident. That single incident is part and parcel of a whole. And if we can prove the one intent, one scheme, if we prove the whole, I mean, that's part of our burden, is we're going to have to prove that whole.
You know,
if the two prior incidents, and grievous ones they were, that were on November 22nd, alleged to have occurred on November 22nd, 2006, and March 13th, 2007, occurred within the statute, wouldn't you have charged them separately?
You know, I think if we separate out the statute of limitations problem, say everything was within the statute of limitations, everything that is alleged, all of the actions, I think it's still a better case charged as a continuing course of conduct for the reason I would like the jury to see the entire crime, not just a portion of the crime, the whole crime. You know, obviously it's a case-by-case kind of thing as far as the prosecutor's decision. In certain cases, the prosecutor might decide, no, I just want to charge this one single incident. In other cases, like this one, the decision may be made, I want to give the whole crime.
But would that give rise to the possibility of the prosecutor circumventing the protections of Rule 404B just by the charging decision, in essence, shortcuts all the inquiry that would normally go into deciding whether each of those prior incidents was similar enough, close enough in time, had enough evidentiary significance and the like to decide whether it should be put in front of the jury, and basically takes that decision from the judge and gives it completely to the prosecution? Is that an appropriate result?
It does in this fashion. It does so, and I understand the concern about that, because the way we do it is by definition. We define it away, right? I mean, we say these are not prior acts. These are charged acts. Therefore, 404B doesn't apply. And stated that way, I know it sounds a little too cute, you know? But let's say something like that did happen, that rather than charging what in reality were distinct incidents, five distinct incidents within 3 days, and we charge them as a continuing course of conduct. I think the protection on that is when a state rests And the defense moves for judgment of acquittal before the judge. One of the things the judge is going to have to analyze is, did we present a prima facie case that these were connected? If there was no connection, then the concern that you raised, that were we just trying to get around 404B, now comes before the court. It says, you charge these five incidents that are totally unconnected? Well, you charge them as continuing course of conduct, so now the boom gets lowered because you didn't present enough proof to show the connection. You lose the whole thing. Right, so I think there that is the solution as far as if to curb any kind of abuses regarding 404B. Like if we're just trying to, I mean, an extreme example would be like if we charge five incidents and then we go to trial and it turns out those five incidents were against five different victims. And there was no common scheme.
Well, how about the 50-year relationship where there were two incidents maybe in the early years of the relationship and then nothing for 30 or 40 years and then horrific incidents over the course of a couple of months at the end? By charging it as a continuing course of conduct, the incidents from 50 years ago would come in, although under a typical 404B analysis, very unlikely they would come in.
Right, right. And if we were charging it as a continuing course of conduct, I mean, my answer is that speaking strictly legally and conceivably, yes, conceivably that could be done. But what I would anticipate to be the immediate response from the defense is a motion to dismiss for pre-accusation delay. Since this thing was 50 years ago, we have actual prejudice. Any witnesses that we had neighbors that were over, we had that, those people are gone.
Well, let's take that up a bit, because that was a concern that I was thinking about, because I've never really seen a complaint quite like this one, where it alleged a time period of a couple years where the offense occurred. I was trying to figure out when the offense had occurred, and I had never seen anything like this, and I was going to ask you, is there anything of a Hawaii case where we've upheld the lack of specificity of a date that wasn't a child sex abuse case? Do you know of any case that's ever been charged like this that wasn't a child?
Well, not charged like this, but I'm sorry, I can't think offhand. Is it Territory v. Hayes or something like that holds that the unless time is of the essence of the charge, that the allegation of time is not...
But those are on or about. This is a 2-year period. And just taking up what you said, the pre-indictment, I was thinking how the defense attorney was going to prepare for a case where suppose there was an alibi or something like that, and you've given them a 2-year period. How are they going to defend against a charge like this that specifies no date and says, hey, this is what you were doing over a 2-year period, and this is not, as I repeat, a child case, where the child, even in children cases, I haven't seen anything quite like this. Usually the children cases, there's location or place or something. This is about, it can't be any broader.
In answer, I think that's where the issues of factual issues and issues of proof would be brought up in motions, pretrial motions.
But the jury's not going to have to find any date because you didn't allege anything.
No, what the jury would have to find is that the defendant intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly caused physical abuse against the complainant as a continuing course of conduct over this period of time.
And they're going to have to find proof beyond a reasonable doubt some act which you have not specified occurred in the limitations period.
Right. I think they would be instructed as to what the definition of the statute of limitation is, that there has to be, that continuing course of conduct would have to end within the statute of limitations, and they would have to make a finding regarding that, that we would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that some act that was part of that continuing course of conduct occurred within the statute of limitations. So I agree. But that doesn't go, those difficulties as to certain cases like this one, statute of limitations, don't directly address what I think is the fundamental issue here is, does the abuse statute permit continuing course of conduct charging.
What's your answer to the observation or the suggestion that this, the approach that you're arguing for here is inconsistent with the sort of graduated penalty scheme in the statute, that subsequent offenses are punished more significantly, and that would reflect a legislative intent to charge individual instances rather than encompass individual instances in one offense, and we'd be undercutting or acting contrary to that intent by allowing the kind of charge you had here?
The fact that the legislature created that kind of a scheme specifically for abuse and within the abuse statute, 709-906, indicates to me that they saw this as a repetitive crime, that this is something that we and that they anticipate would be repeated, and that's why there was they responded with that graduated increasing penalty.
How does that differ from DUI? OVUII. Repeated OVUII. Is that a continuing offense?
I'm sorry, it's been decades since I did an OUI, and I know the law has changed a lot. I'm not really familiar with.
Well, there's enhanced penalties for multiple, what is it, the fourth conviction in 10 years is a felony. Uh-huh.
I think, well, that makes sense from the standpoint that certainly if somebody has been caught driving drunk, there may be an alcohol problem, and they will
Why is
probably
that not a continuing course of conduct under your theory then? Someone with an alcoholic that keeps driving drunk.
If they were, I think conceivably, you could do so, but the issue, I think it would be difficult as far as proof, because you'd have to prove that.
Wouldn't that be a Modica problem also? Same proof, you could charge it either as a continuing course or four incidents over the course of 10 years, which would be a felony, as compared to a continuing course of one as a misdemeanor, as a petty misdemeanor?
If a person were pulled over and driving drunk, and for some reason he wasn't arrested, but there was proof that he was drunk, and he was allowed to get back in the car, and he was pulled over half an hour later, again, driving drunk, and then again, he was catch and release, just let him go. I guess that would be analogous.
What evidence did you have before the court to show that this was a continuing course of conduct? Let's assume you're correct that abuse is a continuing course offense. What evidence did you have that this satisfied that? What did you put before the court? You put incidents 2 years apart. I mean, did you show anything that the defendant said, hey, I'm going to be doing this, like in my example earlier, I'm going to do this every day? I mean, you can't just put two police reports before the court and say that's sufficient.
No, and this was not a JA motion. It was a motion to dismiss on legal issues.
Right, but there. But as a matter of law, couldn't right. The court say, "Look, you have put nothing before us to show that these offenses were any way interconnected, or that there was a common intent." There was nothing before the court, and if you're going to take the position that you can do this in every case, or the evidence that wasn't really evidence that those victim witness experts who didn't testify, and those were just attachments. But even so, that's generic testimony.
I made offers of proof. I attached basically what amounts to offers of proof to the memorandum.
But that's generic. I'm saying for this specific case, what did you have before the court that would have gotten you past a dismissal motion that there was no evidence whatsoever that these acts were connected?
I presented no evidence.
Okay.
And the court could not dismiss my case because I presented no evidence, because trial hadn't started yet. They can do that after I rest. When I've had a full opportunity to develop my case, then they can dismiss the case because I don't have enough evidence. But prior to trial, they can't dismiss my case because I don't have enough evidence. That's why I say the motion to dismiss, it was not an evidentiary hearing, it was a legal issue.
Mr. Yika, can I ask you, I know that you're interrupted, so it's not your fault. Can you finish answering the Chief Justice's question regarding whether your desire to charge it as a continuous offense runs contra the stated objective of the apparent objective of the statute.
The graduated punishments.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. And besides the fact that that because there's graduated punishments, that the legislature recognized that this was a crime that would be of a repetitive nature, it does not follow that the legislature was saying that the offenses that the offenses would have to be one incident offenses. For example, if we charge somebody as a continuing course of conduct abuse for whatever period of time, 5 weeks, he's convicted of a misdemeanor. The judge can sentence him to 1 year prison or the mandatory minimum of 1 year probation, 48 hours jail, DVI classes. Okay, so it's a continuing course of conduct that he's convicted of. After he's released, and after probation is served, he commits and we charge him with another continuing course of conduct offense, misdemeanor offense, that over a 3 week period he abused his victim. And we prove that as a continuing course of conduct offense. Now he's subject to the repeat offender. And now he gets, as a mandatory minimum, he could get a year, but as a mandatory minimum, either 1 or 2 years of probation and 30 days jail as a mandatory minimum.
But couldn't one argue the legislature intended for him to get that 30-day mandatory minimum back when he or she committed the second offense that was somehow incorporated into the first continuous offense? That's what they appear to intend, that there be relatively swift and significant escalation of penalties based on repetition of the same conduct. And doesn't the continuous charge seem to undercut that legislative objective?
No, because the language of the statute is the offense. First offense, second offense, third offense. The offense can be for a single incident or the offense can be for a continuing course of conduct. As far as getting, as you mentioned, a more swift and sure
escalation of penalties.
Right. The nature of domestic violence, though, sometimes does not admit of that. You're assuming that when we have a continuing course of conduct, that after the first incident, that's reported. In continuing course of conduct cases, most of the time we have a situation where there are a number of unreported incidents, and that's just the nature of that crime. The only way we can charge and prove a continuing course of conduct case is if the victim has had some kind of change and they come forward and they're now willing to talk about what happens and we can support what they're saying. If the victim is recanting, the only thing we're going to have is the one incident because they're not willing to tell us even about that. They're not going to tell us about previous incidents. They're not going to tell us about other incidents. So the nature of domestic violence is such that I don't think there could have been a legislative intent that as soon as you commit the second offense, that there's going to be swift and sure punishment because there is that second offense may or may not ever be reported.
It may or may not, but when it is, it would appear to be the legislature's intent to punish it more severely.
And the method, one of the methods, or the tool that I'm asking the court allow us to add to what we have is that if that second incident is not reported, the third is not, the fourth is not, the fifth is not, but by the sixth time, she's now coming in and willing to talk and make the reports, then we want to now punish him for everything he did.
So your definition of continuing course is whether or not it's been reported or not?
No. It's as the case of Sid, if there's one intent, one plan. If his intent and plan was to obtain and maintain power and control over the victim by violence, then that's the single intent, single scheme and plan. And the incidents that occurred within that period of time is only part and parcel of that one plan to obtain and maintain power and control by violence. I'm sorry.
No. Anything further, Mr. Higa, at this point?
Only if there are any other questions.
No other questions. Thank you very much. We'll hear now in rebuttal Mr. Jerome.
Thank you. Very briefly, there were a few things that came up during the state's argument that I wanted to address, specifically with regard to how I think that charging this as a continuous offense creates an absurd and unjust result and actually frustrates the legislature's purpose. The first thing that Mr. Higa said is he said that, you know, the crime is not the slap. Well, respectfully, the crime is the slap. That all this other things that Mr. Higa is talking about may be attendant circumstances, but they're not attendant circumstances that have been made elements of this crime. The only attendant circumstance that's an element of this crime is that the people are family or household members. And that's what the legislature has chosen. The legislature wants to criminalize these other sorts of attendant circumstances or make more serious offenses using those attendant circumstances. The legislature is free to do so. It's not the prosecution's job to do that, and it's not this court's job to do that. And possibly the reason why the legislature has done that is because they take the crime seriously and they don't want the prosecution to have to prove all of these other attendant circumstances as elements of the offense. Imagine how difficult that would be to prove if, in order to prove abuse, the state had to prove this sort of general intent to exercise power and control through physical violence. And getting back to this idea that there's one intent, one scheme, one plan, when we're talking about intent in this case, we're talking about intent as an element of the offense. We're not talking about some underlying motive that is what generates the reason for committing the offense. Otherwise, as Justice McKenna brought up, DUI would be a continuous offense for multiple offenses because the defendant could say, oh, well, I'm an alcoholic, so I have to drink, and my intent here is to drive to work, so it's a continuous offense because I have the same general plan or scheme or intent. Intent is an element of the offense with regards to conduct, results of conduct, and attendant circumstances. And the result of conduct in this case is not exercising power and control through physical violence. It's causing bodily injury. That's the only result of conduct that matters. And the legislature, in the legislative history, if the court looks at the legislative history, the legislature continuously talks about the retaliatory and repetitive nature of domestic violence. Retaliatory bespeaks a distinct intent, separate intent from what generates the initial incident. That means you're doing it to get back at somebody for reporting the initial incident. Repetitive is the exact opposite of continuous. Repetitive means something happens over and over again. And the legislature talks about when they eliminate the ability to expunge this from your record, when they make the period to expunge it from your record longer, they talk about they want there to be a complete history of an offender's record of violence. And charging 2 years of multiple discrete incidents as one offense absolutely frustrates that purpose. Because somebody looking at the defendant's record isn't going to know whether this is a single slap predicated on a single argument or whether it's a 2 year period of repeated discrete incidents. The other thing I want to talk about is in State v. Martin, this court recognized that a conviction or an acquittal of a continuous offense bars another prosecution for the same offense committed in a period overlapping any portion of the duration of the first. So as a defense attorney, I read that as meaning if the defendant in this case is acquitted or convicted of this continuous offense of abuse of family or household member, and then something happens 3 months afterwards, I'm going to argue that this is a continuous offense and it should be barred because of double jeopardy. That if the first five things he's accused of doing are a continuous offense just based on the nature of the general relationship between a domestic violence victim and the abuser, then how is this not part of the same general intent, plan, or scheme if I do it 3 months later, but the defendant does it 3 months later?
I'm not sure that the one follows the other. I mean, I don't think the fact that what happens previously has anything to do with what happens subsequently.
And I don't think it does either, but that's what the court in Arceo said, is that interpreting the statute as a continuous offense means that the defendant is insulated from subsequent conviction for multiple acts within the same incident or subsequent incidents with the same victim.
Within that prior time period, not a subsequent time period.
Well, we would argue that the time period overlaps because their relationship overlaps. There's no end to the relationship. But anyways, the allegations in this case consist of multiple distinct repetitive instances of physical abuse over an extended period of time. Multiple separate acts of physical abuse committed over a period of time bespeak separate and distinct intents. The type of offense alleged by the state in this case can only occur under circumstances in which the defendant intended to commit more than one offense in the course of an extended period of time. As in Rabago, this means that the alleged offense cannot be a continuous offense because it necessarily entails multiple impulses and the operation of intermittent forces. This is not a continuous offense, and we ask the court to vacate the opinion of the Intermediate Court of Appeals and issue an order affirming the trial court's order dismissing this case.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jerome and Mr. Higa. The court will take this matter under advisement.